Jiang Qing was now the most powerful woman in the world. She was in charge of giant cohorts of Red Guards that she guided and told who to attack and destroy. High-up members of the Communist Party were seized and paraded in front of tens of thousands of screaming people and forced to confess to thought crimes against the revolution. If they didn't, they were beaten and killed. But in reality, Jiang Qing had lost control. The revolution had never really changed the structure of power in China. And what she and Mao Zedong had unleashed was a vast anger and resentment against the elites that was now bursting out and overwhelming the country. In Beijing, there were mass killings, with bodies being thrown down wells or into communal burial pits. In Shanghai, hundreds of those targeted by the Red Guards committed suicide. But Jiang Qing had become famous in the West. A feminist writer from America called Roxanne Whitaker came to Beijing to interview her. But as she talked to Jiang Qing, Whitaker began to realize that something else was also going on. That Jiang Qing was using her new power to avenge herself on all those who had dismissed her or patronized her in the past. Jiang Qing also had a demon inside her.
One of the main themes of her life was avenging herself against men who wronged her, politically mainly, when she was in her 20s. And she did not strike back against them until the time of the Cultural Revolution, some 20 years later. They still had refused to give her access to the masses and to allow her to work. And she finally destroyed them.
Wow.
They were removed from their posts. They were humiliated before the people. Placards were put up over their chests. They were dragged before the masses. They were humiliated. They were destroyed.
Jiang Qing also turned on everyone who in Shanghai in the 1930s had held her film career back. Studio heads, directors and journalists were dismissed and beaten up. But the worst was saved for the film star Li Lili. Afeni Shakur was now a full-time member of the Black Panther chapter in New York. She was certain that the only solution in America was violent uprising. And she spent her time writing poems calling for revolution. But the problem was that she and many of the others in her cell didn't know what to do to make this happen. They watched enviously as other Black Panthers on the West Coast fought running battles with the police and the military.
All we have to say is all power to the people, and you can jail a revolutionary, but you sure can't jail a revolution. Baby, you're gonna have some dealing to do, because niggas ain't gonna stop until they either get freedom or destroy everything that they run across.
How many of you were?
The question of who to attack in New York got more and more complicated. Some of the Panthers argued that they should target the ruthless landlords who made them live in rotting apartments, and the bankers who refused to lend blacks money so they could never escape from the slums. These, they said, were the agents of imperialist control. But in New York, the majority of landlords and bankers were Jewish.
And we are being exploited by people who are do not live in our colonies, you see, or in our communities, who come into our communities and exploit us every day, you see, and they take the money back to their community. So this is like colonial imperialism in our content, you see. And the people who exploit us in our communities, particularly in New York City, are Zionist Jews.
Afeni Shakur's group came up with a plan. They were going to plant bombs in big department stores like Macy's. And they would also bomb the Bronx Botanical Gardens and attack local police stations. But as they developed the plan, Afeni Shakur began to worry. She didn't want to kill civilians. And she felt they were being bullied into it by one of their group. He was one of the founder members of the cell, whose revolutionary name was Yedwar Sudan. And Afeni Shakur started to be suspicious. She wondered if he might really be an undercover policeman. Shakur told another member of the group about her suspicions, who then went and confronted Yedwar Sudan. Sudan immediately pulled out a gun, fired two bullets into the table in front of him, and denied it. He said that Afeni Shakur was just being a typical emotional woman. And the group believed him, not her. When Michael X came out of jail, he found that the world had completely changed, but not in the way he had hoped. The middle-class radicals, who only a year before had been his most fervent supporters, suddenly didn't want to know him anymore. In Notting Hill, no one talked of violent revolution or of bringing down the corrupt power structure. Instead, a new group had turned up. They looked like young radicals, but they had a rather different agenda.
And there's no more war, 'cause there's no more world.
Hundreds of student volunteers from all over the country had come to do a massive survey of everyone who lived in Notting Hill. It was the beginning of what was called community action. They were going to use the data to create neighbourhood centres, which they said would be a different way of empowering the local people.
Parts of Notting Hill are closed off from the general mainstream of society, treated differently from society, sometimes treated as a social dustbin, sometimes treated as a ghetto.
Hello. Lighting. You've got?
We've got the lighting. We pay for it ourselves.
And you pay for it yourself?
Yes, and the heating.
Cleaning. Well, this doesn't really apply to you. This applies to other people. In other sorts of rented accommodation.
We pay for ourselves.
You do that yourself?
Yes.
Also, room service doesn't really apply either, I imagine. No.
Good afternoon, friends. I'm Charles Blank from the United States Census Bureau. Are you the janitor of this building?
Yes, I'm Mr. Harris, the janitor.
Mr. Harris, is apartment 3 vacant, or is someone living there?
What business is it of yours, Mr. Blank?
I see. I have to fill a questionnaire for the apartment, even though no one is living there. Can you answer a few questions?
I'm not talking to anybody.
Is apartment 3 intended for year-round or seasonal occupancy?
You nosy bastard. Take your form and get out of here.
Is it for rent or for sale?
You're not getting anything out of me. I don't like your look.
Would you stick to that? How many living quarters, occupied and vacant, are at this address?
Hey, are you a stuck record or something? Don't you understand? I'm not giving you any of these questions to answer them.
Does apartment 3 have complete kitchen facilities?
Hey,
complete kitchen facilities are a sink with piped
here.
Water, a range
red,
or cook
American
stove,
flag.
And a refrigerator. Is it for that unit
you know
only?
What? Or are there you need some help with this guy, Harry.
How many rooms are in apartment 3? Do not count bathrooms, porches, balconies,
right,
foyer halls,
listen,
or
listen, hey, Blank. Hey, you giving my friend Harry any trouble?
Is there hot and cold piped water in this building?
Let's throw him out.
Does apartment 3 have a flush toilet?
Yes, and you're going right down it. Come on, with me.
For apartment 3 only, or is it you?
No, you're not.
But soon, many of the local black residents who were involved with the project resigned. because power seemed to remain firmly with the white professionals.
Can we go in an orderly fashion and no damage to the property at all, please?
Well, what made me resign was because I don't think that enough local people were being involved. You see? And by local people, I mean West Indians. Students can't do much. They're relegated to a role of just getting information.
Isn't that worthwhile?
Well, I suppose it's worthwhile, but it depends on how the information will be used afterwards.
The aim of Black Power had been that people would organize themselves so they could stand up against those who ruled them. Michael X realized that what was happening now in Notting Hill was the opposite. People were being treated as subjects to be counted and measured and managed. He became increasingly cynical about the Liberals' real intentions.
These places always have fantastic basements.
Oh, this is a tremendous place if you've got the money.
If you want to have a party.
A few years ago, you were reported to have said that whites who claim to help you are out to kill you. Do you still believe that?
Yes, I'm thinking when I said that, I was referring to people who are described as white liberals. They are some of the most vicious people I find in this country. For the simple reason, anywhere, not just in this country, because they're the kind of people who come to black neighborhoods ostensibly to help black people.
Michael X had come to believe that the talk of revolution had just been empty rhetoric that disguised something else. The new groups might look like radicals and dance to black music, but really, they were the children of the colonialists who had run the empire. And they had no intention of giving up their power. That old system of power was simply mutating, morphing into a new form that camouflaged itself in radicalism, but still would manage and control. Michael X was an ambitious man who had badly wanted political power.
I don't see anything to be terrified about powerful black people. I'm a pretty powerful black man. I'm the most powerful black man in Europe.
But now he saw that he was never going to get it. So he decided that he too would revert to the old forms of power that he knew well. Extortion and violence. He set up a new organization called the Black House. It deliberately excluded whites. He still talked of violent revolution, but really, it was a front for taking over drug dealing in parts of London. He also persuaded John Lennon and Yoko Ono, who had shaved off their hair, to donate it and a large amount of money to the Black House. Michael X took the money and pocketed it for himself.
Michael was putting every single cent he could get in his own pocket. He didn't care about black people.
What did they think of him in the end when it failed?
Well, they thought he was just a cheap con man. They lost faith in Michael in the end. But he was just playing his games, you know.
Why do you think he did that?
Because Michael doesn't believe in black power. Michael is just on a power trip for his own benefit. Michael doesn't like black people because Michael is half white.
In a short time, I'm going to ask you to put your face up against that face piece and look in this box while I ask you to solve some multiplication problems in your head. The problems will be relatively simple. They'll be given to you verbally, and I will ask you to give me the answer verbally back. Give me only the answer. Once you have given me the answer, dismiss the problem from your mind, and we'll go on to a next one.
As two postmen times three animal control officers divided by two gas meter readers makes how many bendable integrated community workers? Decode your answer. Now. Did you remember the cahier de bombe? Good. The answer...
Many psychologists had begun to take Dr. Hesse's experiments with the pupils of the eye further. They were fascinated by the idea that there might be other forces inside the mind that people themselves weren't aware of. One of them was a young psychologist studying in America called Daniel Kahneman. His fascination with the complexity of the mind had come from a moment of terror when he was a child living in Nazi-occupied France during the Second World War. One day he had been stopped by an SS officer. Kahneman was a Jew, and the SS was in charge of sending people to the death camps. He was convinced that he was about to be sent away to be killed. But the SS man picked him up, kissed him, and showed him pictures of his own son in Germany. Kahneman decided that the human mind was very strange and full of contradictory impulses. Now, he, along with other psychologists inspired by Dr. Hess, studied the pupils in people's eyes as they gave them all kinds of problems to solve while distracting them with music and noise.
223.
They were trying to probe further into the human brain to see how it responded to the world outside in ways that the individual wasn't aware of. But as Kahneman and the others watched the individuals in their laboratories, isolated from the society outside, they were led down a very strange path. That in the age when the individual self was going to become the central focus, from politics through to consumerism, the scientists were going to come to the conclusion that maybe the conscious self wasn't fully in control of what humans did. 35 years later, Kahneman was going to be given the Nobel Prize for a theory that began with his work in the 1960s. He would come to believe that what we think of as the self is really just a small part of something else hidden inside our brains. A much larger part of the brain that actually experiences the world outside. But that experience makes no sense. It is just an ongoing, chaotic rush of biochemical data that flashes up and fades away. And what humans think of as their self is actually an accessory that tries to make sense of this chaotic mass of incoming data. But to do that, it has to simplify and turn that data into stories that are sometimes so simplified that they bear little relationship to the reality outside. It gives people the feeling that they are in control, but that is just a comforting illusion. Kahneman's theory was going to have a far-reaching influence beyond psychology, because the implication of what he was saying was that you could never change people's behavior by appealing to them rationally. And in a strange way, Kahneman was saying the same thing as the left-wing revolutionaries. Human beings did live in a simplified dream world, but what he was saying was that there was nothing you could do about that. And in an age of individualism, when you could no longer order people about, the only solution was to keep them in that dream world and to make sure the dream world was safe and happy.
Come right here. So beautiful, this area.
The Future Fair. A fair for all and no fair to anybody. Yes, it's free. Join the expectant crowd gathering now as we stop here on
Dutch Elm Street.
Holy Come fun. Closer, folks. Don't crowd the wheels.
The idea of appealing to them rationally and changing the world was pointless.
你面前的正是两条路!
Then suddenly, Mao turned on Jiang Qing. At a public meeting of those in charge of the Cultural Revolution, he told her, "You are someone who has grandiose aims, but puny abilities. Great ambition, but little talent." Jiang Qing realized that she was being dropped. In her operas, Jiang Qing had gone back into China's past. Her aim had been to rework them, to express a new kind of revolution. But in reality, she had reawakened a dark and poisonous violence that had lurked under the surface of China for hundreds of years. It was driven by a resentment of the rigid hierarchies that the revolution had not really changed. Mao had not given her or anyone else guidance about what to do with the fury that she had summoned up. And now she knew why. He had simply been using her and the violence that she created as a way of destroying all opposition to him. He had no other vision of how to solve the old divisions and resentments in China. His only aim had been to get rid of all his rivals in the party. Jiang Qing had been betrayed yet again. The members of the Red Army faction were now planting bombs and robbing banks all across West Germany. They announced that they had now become Maoists, followers of Mao Zedong, and they were going to awaken the popular masses. The government were desperate to catch them. And they turned to a man who said he knew how to find them. He was called Horst Herold. He was the head of a tiny federal crime investigation unit. It had no real power because any national police system was prohibited by law to stop Nazism from ever re-emerging. But Herold insisted that the only way to catch the terrorists hidden in the cities was to reintroduce control from the center. His solution was to use a computer because there was no law to stop that. Working day and night inside a protected complex, Herold created a giant computer network that monitored the movements of millions of people. He also fed into the computer vast amounts of data, not just about the terrorists themselves, but others, who, in his words, represented a danger. Individuals that data showed might become terrorists in the future. From all this, Herold created what he called logical sequences, patterns drawn from the data that predicted where the terrorists might be hiding in the cities. What he had invented was a new, rational bureaucracy working from the centre in which information was controlled. It was the start of mass electronic surveillance, and it caught the terrorists. But Horst Herold was not just an unthinking technocrat. By studying all the data, he believed, come to understand that the terrorists were just a tiny part of something much bigger, that was happening all across the world. Something that those in power did not yet comprehend. And in 1973, he made an extraordinary speech that laid out the world that he saw coming. The violence and the horror that the terrorists created, he said, did not just happen because of something evil or sick inside their heads. It was a reaction to the new system of power that was rising up across the world. It was the system that the radicals had identified in the 1960s. The new global networks of multinational corporations and international finance that they believed were ruthlessly exploiting the world. If you want to get rid of the terrorism, Harold said, there are two alternatives. You either use political power to change and reform that global system, or you decide to systematically control the people and their anger and their discontent. But to do that, you would have to create surveillance networks like the one he had built, but on a global scale. In Notting Hill, all the politics had gone. The counterculture had transformed completely into a new kind of consumerism, with self-expression at its heart.
Oh, wow. Look at the stars, man. Wow, the stars, there's so many of them.
That's hot, man.
Really?
For sure. Whatever.
Wow, yeah.
Hey, guy, how's the divorce?
Oh, great. We divided our kids between our two lawyers.
Oh, wow, you got Solomon and Solomon, huh? Yeah, they divided our kid, too.
That's hot.
Really?
For sure.
Whatever.
Oh, wow.
Okay, watch out, guys. Hot stuff behind you.
Move over. Oh,
look at this, huh? I ought to be in porno. That's where the money is.
Here, smoke this.
Oh, no.
I'll hold it. Your hands are right.
Grass is for hippies.
Hey, you know, me and the girlfriend, we really got to move to a bigger house. Mm. But the bank wants it down in coke.
Oh. Money, man, it's tough. I had to pay my dentist bill with my gold fillings.
Go for it.
Oh, for sure.
Whatever.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Hey.
What?
When I put the towel over my face like this, what do I look like?
Gary Gilmore.
No, one of the hostages.
Ooh. Oh, that's heavy.
Yeah, who isn't?
Yeah, for sure.
Who isn't heavy?
No, who isn't a hostage?
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Sure.
Hey.
What?
Ugh, is this a hair? Hair in the hot tub? Oh, gross. Man.
Gross out.
Gross out, man.
No, man, that's... Here, you, man. That's the Siamese seaweed soap, man.
Oh.
Hey, long hair is
what?
Short hair.
What?
Hair is dead, huh?
Yeah, right. Go for it, Baldy.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, for sure.
Whatever.
Oh, oh wow.
Wow.
Hey, wow.
Hey, any of you guys think that maybe this hot tub's too hot?
Oh, ask Pam Jurgensen, man. It's her hot tub. Give me that.
Oh. Man. Hey, where is Pam Jurgensen?
Pam, honey.
She's around.
Hey, look there. Down there in the Siamese seaweed.
Oh, wow. Poached. That's hot.
Really?
For sure.
Whatever.
Michael X left London in disgust, and he went back to Trinidad. He moved into a large house hidden away in the suburbs. He said that he was going to set up a new radical organisation – called the University of the Alternative. But it was clear that he was in a manic state of mind and increasingly paranoid. Then one night, the compound burned down and Michael X disappeared. The police found a hidden grave in the garden. In it was the body of one of Michael X's last disciples, Gail Benson, the daughter of a Conservative MP. She had discovered that Michael X's real plan was to grow marijuana and export it to the United States. So he had ordered a group of his men to kill her. He told one of them, Steve Yates, that she was an undercover agent from the CIA.
She was seized from behind and stabbed several times across the body with a knife. She was struggling very violently, and Steve Yates, who wasn't even supposed to be part of this particular operation, became impatient. He grabbed a cutlass, which in these parts is a long knife used for cutting sugarcane, and plunged it straight into her neck. Well, that was the fatal blow. The men then piled stones on top of her and filled in the rest of the grave. Sometime later, Marlick phoned the house to see what the situation was, and Steve Yates simply told him, the tree is planted.
Michael X fled to Guyana. He then headed south, away from the towns, down a small trail past mining camps. His aim was to get to the river and take a boat upriver into the jungle where he would be safe. It was the same jungle that Edgar Mittelholzer had described in his story about the ghosts from the colonial past. But there was one person who was about to show that even in the growing mood of paranoia and defeat, an individual who believed in the idea of revolution could take on the power of the state and defeat it. One morning, armed police stormed into Afeni Shakur's apartment and arrested her. All the other members of her cell were also arrested. They were charged with what the government said was a giant plan to destroy those elements of society which the defendants call the power structure. It included attacking police stations and planning to bomb five large department stores and the Bronx Botanical Gardens. They became known as the Panther 21. Their trial was held in a state of paranoia about further attacks by the Panthers. But it also caused a sensation when it was revealed that three of the founding members of the group had been undercover police officers. What was stranger was that some of those officers seemed to have been unaware that there were other undercover agents in the cell. They were also the most active members of the group. We had to organise everything, one of the undercover agents explained at the trial, because everyone else in the group was off doing what they called their own shit. The prosecution claimed that the group had been inspired by violent revolutionary propaganda, and in particular, by the film The Battle of Algiers, made about the Algerian struggle against French colonialism. They showed the film in the court. Unlike all the other Panthers, Afeni Shakur chose to defend herself. And at the end of the trial, she cross-examined the leading undercover agent. He was the man she had suspected from the start, Yedwar Sudan. His real name was Ralph White. A journalist who was in the courtroom wrote a book that described what happened. She started by getting White to admit that really most of the inspiration for the plots came from the undercover agents. Not only had they continually pushed for the violence and suggested the targets, but they had also arranged to buy the dynamite off yet another undercover agent. And they had also arranged for the cars to transport the dynamite. That really, the plot to attack America had been created and driven by the American authorities. But then Afeni Shakur went further. She talked to White in the courtroom, not as a police officer, but as a comrade that she had spent 18 months with, and asked him about the activism that they had done together in the community. He said that he thought what they had done was powerful, inspiring, and, he said, beautiful. She asked if he had misrepresented the Panthers to his police bosses. He said yes. She asked if he had betrayed the community. He said yes. When the jury was sent out, they talked for 40 minutes, came back and acquitted all the defendants. It was a powerful example of how an individual could challenge those in power and win. But at the same time, the revelations at the trial of how the Panthers had been penetrated and manipulated fed the growing paranoia that was tearing the radical movement apart. All four, Jiang Qing, Afeni Shakur, Michael X and the German revolutionaries, had all set out to try and confront their societies and change the structure of power. But all of them, in different ways, had unleashed violence that was lurking underneath those societies. The roots of that violence lay back in the past, in anger and resentment against those in power who had made their different countries rich and powerful, but to do that had ruthlessly exploited others and had kept much of the spoils for themselves. The violence had burst out in different ways, across whole societies, among groups, and inside the revolutionaries' own heads. But all of them became overwhelmed by the paranoia and suspicion and the horror that resulted. And all of them had failed in their aims. Now, those in charge of the societies wanted to get rid of that violence, to wipe it and hide it away. And in Germany, the revolutionaries were going to help them do it. In 1976, two of the remaining German revolutionaries helped Palestinians hijack an Air France plane. They flew it to Entebbe in Uganda. What happened next shocked the world. The terrorists took the hostages into the departure hall. And then they began to separate the Israeli passengers from the non-Israelis. The Israelis were the ones who would be executed if the plane was stormed. To the other radicals watching from inside prisons in Germany, who had dreamed of revolution, it seemed as if those dreams had now led them to behave exactly as the Nazis had done.
Was it frightening when you realised that that was happening?
Yeah, of course, awfully frightening. This is one of the main points in the development, the awareness that we are from the same stuff as the fascists were. We understood something. We understood that fascism is a component in all of us. But we don't know to handle this contradiction. We don't have any mean to live with this evil part in ourselves.
The Israelis mounted a rescue at Entebbe. The hostages were saved, and the terrorists were killed. But the Germans' behaviour in the hijack had an incredibly powerful effect on radicals and liberals all across the West. 3 years before, the man who had been chasing the terrorists, Horst Herold, had argued that the violence did not just come from inside them, that they were reacting to something that was happening in the world. But now, the revolutionaries and many of their supporters began to argue that maybe the violence was not in the system. It was inside them. A year later, a group of their supporters captured and killed a leading industrialist called Hans-Martin Schleyer. He had also been a leading Nazi in the war. At the same time, three of the leading revolutionaries killed themselves in prison. In an extraordinary moment, on one day in October 1977, two funerals were held in the same city, Stuttgart. One was for the revolutionaries. Hundreds of their supporters flooded into the cemetery, watched by 1,000 armed police. The other was for Hans-Martin Schleyer. The leaders of the industrial and financial establishment came together at a church in the centre of the city. It was a moment that dramatically symbolised what had happened. The industrialists and the bankers had come not just to mourn Schleyer, but to bury any idea of radical change in Germany. And for the radicals, it was the moment, after all the violence and all the failures, when pessimism finally took hold. It said that this is what all radical attempts to change the world inevitably lead to. And in the growing age of the individual, it led to the conclusion that the fault is inside you, the individual, not in society. Those who had wanted to change the world now began to turn inwards. This distrust was going to be reinforced by the growing influence of the psychologists, who said that human beings were really irrational and lived in a dream world. Out of that was going to come the modern system of power, in which psychology would join with economics and with finance to make sure that that dream world was managed. It would be a wonderful world to live in, but its weakness would be that at its root was a pessimism about human beings and whether they should ever be allowed any control. While outside the dream world, the things that the revolutionaries had wanted to change so much, the inequalities, the racism and the exploitation, would all remain untouched and would continue to grow unnoticed. But some of the revolutionaries saw what was happening and adjusted. Eldridge Cleaver, who had been one of the leading Black Panthers, set up his own fashion company. He designed what he called revolutionary trousers. They had a flap at the front, which he said would liberate the penis. While his fellow revolutionary, Bobby Seale, became a celebrity chef.
Featuring the founding chairman of the Black Panther Party and gorilla extraordinaire, Bobby Seale.
How'd you get in here?
It's all in front of
Darn, Seale. I don't remember. Well, where were you before?
Here's another item, a lovely miniature executive in a brown tweed suit from a front room office.
I sold out.
So here's your last deal, Miss Kresge. Now, which would you rather do? Hit this Jew over the head with a bag of sugar or beat out that rhythm on a drum? Come on, love.
I'll take the bag.
But one revolutionary was still not going to give up. Zhang Qing now joined with three others who had run the Cultural Revolution. They were determined to seize power when Mao died. They were known as the Gang of Four. Michael X never made it to the river. He was captured and brought back to stand trial in Trinidad. He was found guilty of murder and hanged. And in the future, the violence and the anger would be played out in the artificial world of culture. It would be the images and the words of revolution. But in reality, nothing ever really changed. And what was forgotten in this new age, including by the psychologists who were exploring the self by drilling ever deeper, was that what you are and what you feel comes not just from inside you, but from where you are in the power structure, because that flows through you too.
When you see an individual white boy, you're not afraid of that individual white boy. What you are afraid of is the power that he represents, because behind him stands the local police force, the state militia, the army, the navy, the air force. When you see an African, there is no power behind him. There is no one speaking for his interests. There is no one to protect him. The gorilla studies. The gorilla studies. He doesn't rap. He studies and keeps his mouth shut. Study, children.